Welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. And I think this is going to be a really important interview. I'm talking with Dr. Todd Bourne, and we're going to be exploring really some of the context and the background of chronic fatigue syndrome. So we're going to be looking at things like diagnostic criteria, some of the signs and symptoms people experience, some of the difficulties in getting a clear diagnosis. And we're also going to use that as a pathway to explore some of the treatments and interventions that can be effective. So firstly, welcome to us. Thank you so much for being with me.
Sure. Thank you, Alex. Appreciate it.
Let me just give people your kind of full backgrounds, and then we'll jump in. So Dr. Bourne is a naturopathic physician and certified nutrition specialist. He is co-owner and medical director of Bourne Integrative Medicine Specialists, PLLC. Dr. Bourne is a product manager, head of new product development, scientific advisor for Allergy Research Group, who is one of the sponsors of this conference, and is editor-in-chief of their science-based focus newsletter. Dr. Bourne is also lead advisor and president of the International Society for Naturopathic Medicine, as well as a medical wellness advisor for the International Medical Wellness Association. Dr. Bourne graduated from Bastyr University in Seattle and completed his residency at the Bastyr Center for Natural Health and its 13 teaching clinics, with rotations at Evergreen, Harborview Medical Center's emergency medicine departments, and Virginia Mason Hospital's Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation Spine Clinic. He's been published in Naturopathic Doctor News and Reviews, Townsend Letter, Integrative Medicine Alerts, Natural Medicine Journal, Holistic Primary Care, and The Natural Nutmeg. He has appeared on, is that Cron4? Cron4 News. This is Cron4. English, is it? Multiple national radio shows and lectured as an expert for the National Psoriasis Foundation and Arthritis Foundation. He has also lectured around the country and internationally at various medical conferences. Dr. Bourne's clinical focus is utilizing integrative medicine to treat chronic disease. There's a strong interest in difficult and refractory cases, allergies, gastrointestinal issues, neurological and neurodegenerative disorders, endocrinology, cardiovascular disease and diabetes, autoimmune disease, development and behavioral issues, HIV, AIDS and geriatrics. Otherwise known as, you have a lot of interests and you've been working very, very hard. Todd, thank you so much for making some time to talk with me. As I was saying at the start, we're going to give a bit of a context and background in terms of these conditions. Maybe just a starting point before we jump in, I guess I'm just curious a little bit around what got you interested in working with such challenging, complicated areas. You could have picked an easier life for yourself. So I'm curious as to what the kind of passion was there.
That's a good question. And thanks again, Alex, for putting this conference together. I think it's really needed because fatigue is, you know, a really nebulous diagnosis and there's so many underlying causes of fatigue. And I think it's actually poorly addressed unless an organic cause is found, right? Oh, you have iron deficiency anemia. Let's just treat that. Symptoms go away. For me in my practice is that a lot of doctors or NDs may specialize and say, you know, I'm the autoimmune expert. But for me, I just liked the idea of, say, a family practice and not knowing what's going to come to the door and seeing a lot of different cases every day. It was just much more interesting to me. And also rewarding in the fact that when you have these patients who are very, very sick for a very long time, and almost all patients are usually referred to me by a family or a friend or even another doctor in the community, it's just very rewarding to see someone who comes in with rheumatoid arthritis and their hands are all gnarled up to be able, and they have no quality of life, right? And they're 40 years old, they've got nothing, they can't even play with their kids, to be able to say, you know, I can help you. And there's a lot of things we can do that aren't overwhelming. And so I just like the fact of doing a lot of different things and being very eclectic and seeing a lot of different patients with a lot of very complicated diseases. I like the puzzle. Mm. Let me just put it that way.
It's funny you say that. At the Oxford Health Clinic, that's exactly the analogy we use, to the point that our logo is pieces of a puzzle. So that's, yeah. I love that you said that. That's absolutely how we see it. So maybe to jump in a bit, let's open it up with some of the diagnostic criteria. One of the enormous challenges with this group of conditions can be just getting clarity in terms of diagnosis. It's obviously varying opinions, there's different diagnostic criteria. So maybe say a little bit about how, as a physician, as a practitioner, how do you go about getting clarity in terms of diagnosing people? And what's the kind of methodology you use for that?
Sure. I'll switch to a screen share so you can kind of see, have a better visual of what's going on. Is that first, there's different terminology, right? Because I think you're probably going to have listeners from all over the world. In the United States, it's chronic fatigue syndrome. In the UK, myalgic encephalomyelitis. From the Mayo Clinic, right, this very large, prestigious institution in the United States, they actually want it to be called chronic multifactorial fatigue. And the Institute of Medicine, which is similar to the World Health Organization, it's an independent body. In 2015, they said, you know, none of those really actually do a good job describing what this syndrome is. All right. What is a syndrome? A syndrome is nothing more than a constellation of symptoms. And then you just get lumped into something. We don't really have a full definition or ideology of it. So they actually redefined it to be much more indicative of what the signs and symptoms of the disease is. So they want it to be called systemic exertion intolerance disease, or SEID. But for simplicity and the fact that most people are not aware of that mouthful, we'll just call it CFS and chronic fatigue throughout our discussions here. And there actually is different diagnostic criteria, and I don't know how it works in other parts of the world, but the United States, we like to make things more complicated, I think. So it really depends on who, what academy, what governing body you're following to meet a criteria. I like the IOM because they're independent and they're very thorough, and they try to be as unbiased as possible. So what they say for chronic fatigue syndrome is that you actually have to have a substantial reduction or impairment in the ability to engage in your pre-illness levels of life, right? So you were going about your day, and then all of a sudden now you have these symptoms. You also have to have post-exertional malaise. So these are people, when they exercise, it's not your normal, oh, I got some muscle fatigue after I exercise. These people are wiped out. And you also have to have unrefreshing sleep. You all, those have to have all three. Then you also need one of two other manifestations, either some type of cognitive impairment or an orthostatic intolerance. And that could be anywhere from, you know, you basically bend over and you get back up and you get lightheaded, which happens a lot of the times to normal people. But this happens, people with chronic fatigue syndrome happens all the time, to the point also where they can have syncope and just faint. The other thing is that their heart rate goes up, those kind of things. And then the key to not only having the three mandatory pieces, but then either cognitive impairment or some kind of hypotensive issue, is that it has to have happened for at least 6 months straight. It has to be moderate or substantial impact of your life of severity. So it can't just be, well, you know, it's been going on for a few months and it kind of moderately affects my life. That does not mean that someone can actually meet that criteria.
And I think one of the challenges, of course, at this point is that because there is not a biomarker which is being used, effectively, it's a diagnosis of exclusion, right? That you're being clear that it's not other factors and someone meets these symptoms. That's part of the reason why there seems such a variance in terms of people's ability to accurately diagnose.
That's exactly correct. And that there's this, it's a diagnostic conundrum, because in and of itself, the individuals are essentially normal, right? They appear normal. Their biomarkers are normal. The physical exam is normal. Everything seems to be normal in these individuals. But yet you look at the person in front of you and they feel terrible. They look terrible. They feel terrible. They act terrible. But yet their laboratory results are typically normal. Diagnostic imaging is normal. Everything is normal. They say that they feel like they have a fever, but yet they're afebrile when you take their temperature, even they take their temperature. The only thing that has been able to be elucidated is really in research studies looking at some inflammatory cytokines, which we'll discuss later. And actually, when you biopsy their cervical lymph nodes, there's some increase in the number of cells, some hyperplasia, but that's it. And those are the only real manifestations that we can discover thus far.
And certainly our perspective, and I'd be curious as to your thoughts around this, that part of the challenge here is that we are effectively dealing with a number of different subgroups or a bunch of different things happening in different people. And that recognition and definition of subgroups becomes an important way of actually being able to say, well, for this group of people, we might be able to find a biomarker around mitochondrial function. Or for this group of people, we might be able to find some kind of grouping or kind of cluster that have issues with hormones. Or for this group, we might be able to have an inflammation group. But it isn't necessarily that everyone that's affected by these syndromes has the same factors in terms of what's going on.
That's correct, except for when we get into things like this, the Centers for Disease Control or the Institute of Medicine, they're like, we may have all of these disparate symptoms and no two people with CFS may present the same. At least they're going to have some similarities. So the CDC kind of goes a little step further than the Institute of Medicine. Besides the increased malaise and fatigue, they also say that there's going to be persistent muscle pain. They are going to have joint pain, but yet no redness or swelling. They'll have headaches. But it doesn't mean all of these are just the most common manifestation seen. And this is where I see a lot, you know, the cervical and axillary tender lymph nodes, the sore throat that comes and goes, the fever that comes and goes, the difficulties of memory and concentration. And what I also see a lot is that they always say the same thing, right? They are exhausted all the time. And nothing really seems to make a difference. I mean, they're like, I'm drinking two pots of coffee a day and I can sleep holding a cup of coffee. I'm taking bags of supplements. I don't feel any different. And we're going to talk about why. And that's why it's so crucial for the clinician who sees someone who doesn't have, say, the diagnosis yet, and they're coming to you to try to find out what's going on, is to just sit and listen to them and do a thorough history and physical exam, so you can actually catch all these pieces instead of just, you know, getting ready to push them aside and being like, well, you know, you just need to sleep some more or get a new job, you know, and it's all in your head, because we know now that it's not all in people's heads, and we'll talk about that here in a little bit.
So should we come a bit more into some of the epidemiology about this? Because I think just getting a sense of some of the different groups and categories is a helpful way of understanding it. I think one of the misconceptions people can have is that it only happens, some people see a lot of it happening in teenagers, for example, and there can be a perception that this is something that just happens to young people or just happens to females, for example. But yeah, maybe just run us through a little bit some of the data around this.
Sure. And the data always depends on where you are in the world and which group of diagnostic criteria. So the numbers get really complicated. But for me, I like to simplify things. And depending which case definition you're using, we can just use the Institute of Medicine, who has a little bit more stricter definition. They say that there's anywhere between 775 to 6,300 cases per 100,000. Or that roughly translates to, in the United States, they're anywhere between 0.3 and 2.5% of people they meet the definition. Doesn't mean they've been diagnosed. The prevalence worldwide seems to be around 10%. So, you know, that's a lot of people, right? There's 7 billion people in the world, and they're saying there's about a 10% prevalence. That's who's been diagnosed. What about all those people walking around who don't have the diagnosis, they haven't been accurately been able to diagnose, they haven't been treated, they're the guy that doesn't feel like going to the doctor unless his arm is falling off, they just, that's the way it is. But it is about 75% female, at least as far as diagnosis, and it mostly affects young to the middle age. Young is, you know, again, kind of a nebulous thing, but I would say for me, it tends to be like in my practice, which maybe I've seen about 200 cases or so, so not as much as what comes through your clinic since you're a specialty clinic, but I would say it tends to be in the mid-20s, but most of the people I'm seeing with this, they're early 40s, and it's probably the fact that they had it in their 30s, they just powered through until it brought them to the point of seeking professional help. And they're like, look, I can't even function anymore. I mean, I'm not ready to lose my job and go into disability. I'm out of sick days. Something needs to take effect here.
Yeah, I mean, certainly my observation would be that the data seems relatively accurate in terms of the clusters, but it's also worth saying we've had patients, I think the youngest that we've had involvement with has been kind of 8, 9, 10. Obviously, in those cases, it's super tricky because it's hard to really get a sense of what may be psycho-emotional versus what's physical, and there's all kinds of complexities. But up until I have, in fact, one of the patrons of our charity is Shirley Conran, who is in her 80s. So that's a kind of enormously kind of broad range in terms of ages, but there definitely seem to be certain clusters, and it's good that you share that in the data. Maybe say a bit more about some of the signs and symptoms, some of the different ways it can manifest people.
Sure. I mean, the signs and symptoms, you know, tend to be kind of all over the place. And I'm going to share my screen with you so you'll be able to see it better. Is that, you know, it has to be a sudden onset. And this is classic. And, you know, people will say, I was a normal functioning individual. Usually, in my experience, and the data shows this in research papers, that they got an illness, whether it's bacterial or viral. Then all of a sudden, since then, right, and it's different than the usual post-infectious malaise and fatigue that you would see after someone has an infection. This does not resolve, it gets worse. And it's overwhelming. And then usually altered sleep and cognition. And I have a lot of patients with CFS, they have hypersomnia. They sleep too much. They sleep 12 hours a day. They don't wake refreshed. And, you know, they're sleeping all weekend and they still feel like they could sleep more. And there's also excessive physical activity, which exacerbates it. And I wouldn't even put it as excessive, is that these are people that usually say, you know, I go for a walk around the block and I'm fine. But if I take, you know, even a half a block more, and it's not even a steep street I live on, I am wiped out for 2 days. You know, we're talking pretty mild, you know, exercise can completely deplete these people. And usually they typically kind of present as they were high functioning, totally normal, doing their everyday business, and then they got the whammy. A lot of them don't have a progression as far as when you take their history. They're like, no, I was fine. This happened to me. And then it's been downhill ever since. It wasn't even like a progression. And I have a couple of papers here that kind of show what substantiates those pieces. And then the actual underlying etiologies, which we'll get to a little bit later, helps pinpoint where those signs and symptoms. So if they present, like you said earlier, if they present with these things, it's more likely that they're going to have this causation if they present with these. And that's where the important history and physical exam come in.
Should we, I know your next slide is on diagnostic challenges, and we touched on that, but maybe it's worth saying a bit more about some of the, some of the challenges in just getting a clear diagnosis from people. And I appreciate the Harry Potter picture there.
I know, I was trying to find someone who was looking confused and I couldn't find anything good. And I was like, this actually looks like my son when you tell him he can't do something. So I just decided to use the Harry Potter one. And yeah, you're right, is that the patient presents to your office and now they have an infection that's resolved, right? Physical exam is normal for the doctor. They say that they have fever, but they're usually completely normal. They have joint pain, but there's no swelling, there's no redness, and their range of motion is normal. They have fatigued muscles, but only their report. When the doctor goes and we do muscle grading tests or DTRs, those are normal. Cervical and axial lymph nodes are normal, but they say that, you know, they're not. And all of these is because when they present, in my experience, is because when they present to the office, is that they're not in one of their flares. So when they're at home, or if they can get into the office when they're in one of their waxing and waning symptoms, if the underlying etiology is of, say, infectious agent, then when they come in, they will be febrile. They will have pharyngitis. They will have lymphedema where it's painful. So it depends where they are in their syndrome and what the underlying etiologies are, whether we're going to be able to discover it or not. And then it comes to labs, right? So labs are almost always normal. 5% of cases, they might be abnormal, which means you might uncover iron deficiency anemia or maybe some low testosterone or something that is telling you why they're so fatigued.
But quite often those labs that come back with something abnormal can also be red herrings, right? So you get something that comes back that you discover and you think, oh, this must be it. And then you go and investigate it and find resolution. And it doesn't always necessarily impact on the underlying fatigue that's going on.
That's right. So you'll see someone that's like, oh, you've got pretty decent hypothyroidism. Let's treat your thyroid. Thyroid normalizes. And they're like, yeah, I'm 10% better. You know, so you're exactly right, is that, you know, but it's almost, especially if they've been sick for a long time, it's the layers that need to be peeled away. So for me, any inroad I can make, I'm willing to do that. Most of them, they are partially completely disabled by manifestations, but the labs are normal. Radiological imaging is normal. They have these patterns of remission and relapse. And I really only see that in those that have an infectious etiology, not if they have other lying ones, you know, like mold or something else. They look normal, they appear normal, but yet they feel terrible. And, you know, just listening to their story is usually very heartbreaking. And then if it's gone on long enough and their support system is not there, they're accused of being malingerers, their family abandons them, they just call them liars, attention seekers, what have you, and that just makes things worse, because now they just are like, well, maybe it is all in my head, and just they just go further down, you know, the rabbit hole, and it's not something that's
looked at. And I think that it's just worth saying that there's a really strong, I think, correlation between this lack of clear biomarker or diagnostic process and the lack of understanding that we tend to get culturally. Because I think normally if you have a kind of a normal medical condition, let's say, or a kind of, you know, you have cancer or MS, whatever it may be, that you'll hopefully get a clear diagnosis. And then there's a lot of emotional support that will come from friends and family. When there's this kind of cultural question mark around what's happening with these fatigue-related conditions, that often also comes with a level of cynicism and skepticism from the people that are most needed to be helpful and supportive. And I think that can have its own quite negative impact in terms of people's outcomes.
That's right. You know, it doesn't really matter what condition you have. Study after study shows that if you have a poor support network, your outcomes are worse. Even say for a heart attack, for example, studies show that if you have a myocardial infarction, that if you don't have a good support network, you are more likely to get a second infarct and you're more likely to die from that second cardiac arrest than you would if you have a support network. So, and I think even conventional medicine now is starting to make more of that connect of the mind and the spirit and the emotional support versus before everything was so reductionistic. It's like, no, that has nothing to do with anything. And now they're starting to say, you know what, that isn't really the case. And that's another reason why I like these difficult to treat refractory cases. Sometimes they're actually easier than other cases, because these people that come to me, they've been worked up six ways to Sunday. I just get their outside medical records. I just look at them and I just fill in a few gaps and I can say, this is what I think's going on now. They've already had everything done to them. And chronic fatigue syndrome is one of them where usually conventional medicine doesn't have much to offer, right? It's frustrating for both the conventional practitioner and the patient, because they're like, I saw my PCP and they say everything's fine. They don't know what to do. And I'm like, well, I'm glad, you know, they sent you to me. The other thing would be looking at overlapping comorbidities, right? Between chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia. They usually go hand in hand, which makes sense, right? If someone is in chronic pain that has fibromyalgia, they're going to be tired all the time and end up with chronic fatigue syndrome. So is it like chicken or the egg kind of deal?
I think it kind of goes back to this, I think, point around getting physicians that really have the depth of and knowledge and understanding in terms of what's going on. Because often what you'll see is someone that has fatigue with pain and in a certain way, and they'll get lumped with fibromyalgia. Fatigue without pain will get the chronic fatigue diagnosis. And part of how I tend to think about it is these diagnoses aren't really diagnoses. They're just labels for a set of symptoms that people are experiencing. It isn't really telling us what's going on in terms of potential underlying causes. And, you know, that's one of the challenges, that really getting underneath the label to actually what's the presentation of symptoms and what's the potential causes of that in that individual is crucial to getting closer to potential treatment. But yeah, maybe we should say a bit about some of the etiological side of it in terms of the research that's been, at least what the research is saying around that.
That's right. And that's, you're exactly right. In the United States anyway, that's the way, I love conventional medicine and conventional doctors. I trained all along with them during a residency and in hospitals, is that in order for them to be able to treat, they have to have a diagnosis. So if they don't have a diagnosis, they don't know how to really treat or what to do, which is one of the strengths of integrative functional medicine, integrative medicine, naturopathic medicine. We don't need a diagnosis. We need to look at the person who's in front of us and the constellation of all their symptoms, and then look at what's the actual underlying cause. And that's why I believe functional medicine, naturopathic medicine, et cetera, it shines in some of these syndromes more than what conventional medicine has to offer. Because without your diagnosis, they're just like, well, I don't really know. You have a syndrome and we can't find anything wrong with you. It's in your head, you know. And most doctors, I think, now have a kinder heart where their hands are tied. They don't have the training or the skill set to be able to figure it out. So hopefully they refer, or they, you know, kind of send them to someone who does, or they get more training themselves. But there is a big overlap between fibromyalgia and SCID or CFS. And you're right, if they don't have the pain portion of it, they're like, well, you just have chronic fatigue syndrome. And now what I'm seeing a lot, and maybe you guys as well in your clinic, is stimulants being used, because that's the only thing they can treat. They're like, you're tired? Well, let's give you some, you know, methylphenidate. Let's give you Adderall. Let's give you basically pharmaceutical speed to help you. And not against them, right? They're trying to help their patient. They're like, you feel terrible and you're tired all the time? Let's just give you some stuff to perk you up, you know. But that just, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Right. Right? You're borrowing tomorrow's energy for today, right? That's how I think.
That's right. You're just basically going to burn out those adrenals even more, then push the thyroid even more, because the HPA, all that axis talks. So for me, I'm much more into, why do you feel the way that you do? And history and physical exam is where I start to really dig into what I think is going on. So what we know of now, as far as the science, we still don't know what the cause is or causes. But this is what we think are the cause, or even causes, right? You know, in medicine and humans are very dynamic systems. It's usually not just one thing that causes something to go awry. So there's virus and bacterial causes of these, in Epstein-Barr, herpes simplex 6. I mean, the list goes on and on. Tick-borne illnesses, mycoplasma, have all been associated with the onset of chronic fatigue syndrome. There's also this immune dysfunction and dysregulation compared to healthy controls. So at least now, if someone ever says this is in your head, you can pull just this one paper, and there are many, as well as the CDC themselves, that look, we know there's an immune problem, right? You have decreased immune complexes, decreased natural killer cells, as well as their ability to be able to fight infection, altered immunoglobulin G levels, and your CD4, CD8 ratios. They also show increased cytokine production. So inflammatory things are happening in the body that are not happening in those that have controls. And so you can call a malingerer someone all day, but labs don't lie. There might be laboratory errors, but labs don't lie. You know, you draw someone's blood and you run it, it is what it is. And that's the way I see it. The other piece would be, we're now noticing endocrine metabolic dysfunction, which makes sense. That's where this POT syndrome, orthostatic, you know, intolerance comes in, where normally, like, all of us have a certain amount of physical and or emotional stress every day. But in individuals with chronic fatigue syndrome, right, their barometer and tolerance for these perturbations are much smaller. So what might stress you, Alex, or me out, might not necessarily stress them out to the same degree, or vice versa. So we're like, oh, that's too bad. You know, I'm sitting in traffic. For these people, it could be a mild perturbation and it just wipes them out for days. And we know that there is alterations in this hypothalamic pituitary axis, and it's been shown in papers over and over, usually measuring hormone levels and cytokines and cell function.
Very cool. Do you want to continue? Because I know you've got a few more in terms of the possible causes.
Yeah, so we'll hit some more causes, right? Is that there's this neurally mediated hypotension, which is postural.
I wanted you to say that one. Thank you.
I had to practice it a few times, also known as POTS. I see this quite a bit with people. So POTS is postural orthostatic tachycardia. Normally your heart rate is steady. And it is completely normal for someone to go from supine or laying down to sitting up or sitting down to sitting up for the blood pressure to drop slightly and your heart rate to go up a little bit because of just pure gravity of your body pooling. That's a normal response. You don't even feel it. People with chronic fatigue syndrome, they feel it, right? They get lightheaded. They have visual dimming. They get even when people are talking to them, they report like they feel like they're in a tunnel until they recover, and they can become tachycardic, where I've had patients where I do these tilt table tests and their heart rate is say 80 and it might go to 110, 120 just by having them laying down and then sitting up. And then you'll also see their systolic blood pressure drop more than 10 points. That is an abnormal response to a normal stimuli. So we know something's going on. Again, those tests don't lie. So the tilt table is actually quite a useful test for a doctor to utilize in their patients.
And I think it's one of the areas, certainly here in the UK over the last few years, that I think certainly doctors are more up to date, let's say, in terms of their knowledge, are getting better at identifying POTS and diagnosing POTS. And sometimes the more traditional medical interventions in terms of beta blockers and those kind of things can be helpful. And there are certainly cases where people have had a significant improvement in symptoms through that.
That's right. But in our world, ours is yours and my world, is if you actually address the underlying causes, because the adrenal gland is, when we think of POTS, just because your heart rate grows up, to regulate blood pressure, it's very, very involved, right? The lung has things that take over, your kidneys have a role, your adrenal gland has a role, the adrenal cortex and medulla. If you treat all those, particularly the adrenal gland, and get people's blood sugar stabilized, POTS usually resolves. But you're right, sometimes you do need the Band-Aid to get things under control, because the last thing you need is someone who basically faints and hits their head. Right. And now you got basically internal bleeding to worry about. And chronic fatigue is the last of their concerns why they're off to the emergency room. But so there's a time and place for everything.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a great point that you make that dealing with the underlying piece is really the key. And certainly I've seen, as a kind of note of caution, a number of cases over recent years, although there is progress, I think, in terms of at least the medical world getting interested in some pieces of it. But going back to what we were saying a bit earlier, that you can have that 5% of cases where something abnormal does come back, but then it's kind of like all the hope goes into, oh my God, well, I don't have chronic fatigue, or I don't have fibromyalgia, I just have POTS, and I just need to go down this path and I'll be fine. And often it's not quite as simple as that. And the longer term resolution, as you say, is to deal with the underlying factors which are causing what really appears to me, as a non-medical expert, that it appears that POTS is really a set of symptoms for an underlying cause.
That's right, exactly. It's a body's way of showing you what's going on. That's not the cause of it. Something else is causing the POTS. And because this is such a multi-system, multifactorial condition, to get people truly better, all needs to be addressed. And sometimes you have to just dig. And we'll talk about it at the end where, I've even been led astray. I had one patient where she fortunately stayed with me for quite a while. And I'll get into that case where I was doing everything. And I'm like, man, she is just not responding. I don't know why. And then the light bulb moment went off a year and a half into it. And then I did find the underlying cause, and then she was fine. We'll talk about that.
and that's the cases where practitioners grow, right? It's like going to the gym and lifting weights is the one that really stretches the muscle, and that's the one where we get better at what we do.
That's right. When you make, especially when you first get out, right? Because medical school is only so long, residency is only so long, and then all of a sudden you get thrown into the baptism by fire. And when you it's unfortunate the patients have to come across your path to make those mistakes, but that's what gets you to grow and learn, and then things can start becoming predictable. I mean, even when I was in the emergency department, I was rotating with some of these attendings that were doing it for so long, they could tell you what was going on without really doing much. Because they had just seen yeah. so many times these men and women, they're just like, this person is this, and I guarantee you, watch when I do this. And it was really fascinating. And but they don't really see chronic fatigue syndrome, so it's a little more predictable in the ER sometimes.
Yeah.
The other thing would be, I should probably change this part of my slide deck where I have, as an etiology, this neuropsychiatric factors. The studies show that 2/3 of the people or more actually meet the criteria, but it's chicken or the egg. Is it the person has CFS, which without their support, or even if they do have support, they're not getting better? Is that what's making them have some kind of depressive disorder or anxiety disorder? Or is it those conditions that cause them to have that? And I don't think it's really an etiology. I just think it happens to be a comorbidity. It just comes with the condition that even as positive as they are, if you're sick for a really long time, it's really hard to remain positive. And some of the medications you may be getting put on or some of the things you're given might cause some of these. But I have more than 50% of my CFS patients over the years have no psychosocial, you know, disorders whatsoever. They're like, yeah, I feel blue that I'm not getting any better and I'm disappointed, but they don't meet any criteria for a class DSM-5 diagnosis for anything. So I should probably change that out. So note to self. The other thing would be genetics. This is what we see a lot, that there's this apt saying in medicine that genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. So someone usually has to have some type of genetic predisposition for a particular condition. We see this in autoimmune disease. We see it in a lot of chronic disease where, for example, why would, you know, patient X get exposed to an infectious agent and recover? And why would patient B get the same agent, go through the same things, but yet they end up with chronic fatigue syndrome? It usually is a mix of genetics and epigenetics that kind of make it for someone to have a stimuli that sends them down this other path where someone else basically responds. And we have studies in my slide deck if you care to see them. Here's like one where they showed that just polymorphisms, right? Just single nucleotide polymorphisms, a slight change in genetic code where the gene still works, just doesn't work at 100%, shows that people have unexplained chronic fatigue. Here's another study where it showed more polymorphisms show that you have these predictors of chronic fatigue given certain SNPs. And if you look at the SNPs with the COMT variants and some of these other ones, you know, the neural tryptophan, they're not making amino acids correctly. They're not making neurotransmitter. And here they said that these, we talked about difficulty to predict, maybe if some of these genes are run and we understand them in the light of the person in front of us, it actually has a 76% accuracy that someone has a likelihood of getting CFS regardless of the insult, whether it's infectious or it's mold or it's heavy metals. And that's big. I'm not a SNP expert. I believe you talked to Dr. Ben Lynch. That's more of his world. But this is good evidence. One more etiology, which is actually a big news, is mitochondrial dysfunction. And these people actually, it's not that the insult caused their mitochondria to dysfunction. They already had mitochondrial dysfunction. So this is where you'll see the patients that come through your door and they've got bags of supplements and they say that they're no better. And they could be good quality supplements and they're taking really high doses. Here's a study, the first one, that showed that if you put in all of these substrates, it actually had to do with the mitochondria's ability to be able to take these substrates and still produce ATP. They couldn't. So one of the roles then is to fix the mitochondria, help optimize people's genetic potential, and then you can start giving them these nutrients and you'll actually get results. One more would be metabolomics, right? The whole omics thing is exploded, right? You got proteomics, pharmacogenomics, you know, there's too many omics. Metabolomics has to do with the body's ability of metabolites, whether it's something that you've ingested or even just normal part of everyday human physiology and biochemistry because metabolites get produced. Here's a study in, 55 individuals compared to healthy controls, where they did microbiome testing and they did a lot of fancy testing, and they showed that people with CFS compared to healthy controls actually were in a hypometabolic state. So when they also tried to perturb them to different environmental stressors, they actually had a slower response than controls. So again, back to this malingerers and this disease being in someone's head, is that this proves that it doesn't. These people also had a lower production of certain vitamins, branched chain amino acids, their mitochondrial function was lower. All of them, compared to healthy controls, were actually worse off, and 80% of the diagnostic metabolites were decreased in these individuals compared to healthy controls.
I think part of what's really important about what you're sharing here is that it kind of goes back to what we were saying around with the kind of traditional medical world diagnostic criteria. It's kind of, there are no biomarkers. It's a diagnosis of exclusion. If there's nothing else we can find wrong with you and you have these symptoms, we're going to give you the label. And the kind of point that you're making here is that actually, as we go deeper into some of the more functional testing, but also as we look at it from a slightly different lens, in terms of rather than trying to find one thing across the whole population, that looking at some of the different subgroups and some of the different things that are going on, there is a whole different body of evidence that starts to open up, which I think for people watching suffering from fatigue, I hope gives people some kind of reassurance about, although of course they know there's something going on, that actually there is real evidence that absolutely supports that.
That's right. And even for their clinician themselves to say, okay, there is something else that we can test, right? I mean, people in general, particularly clinicians, we're generally very empirical, right? We like numbers, we like, you know, information, and I am very information driven, and I like numbers mostly as a motivation factor to get people to be more adherent to the things that I'm suggesting, but also because you can say, look, you know, we do have some things. A lot of these were in research, you know, institutions. They're not necessarily, some of these tests may not even be commercially available, but the testing the gut microbiome is very available. Doing nutrient testing is very available. Neurotransmitter testing is readily available, but not necessarily diagnostically accurate, because even if you're doing urinary metabolites and it's run through HPLC, which makes it more accurate, and I've spoken to many functional neurologists about this, is that those catecholamines and the neurotransmitters you're testing in urine, organic acids, don't necessarily reflect what's in the cerebrospinal fluid and what's in the brain. But it can give people good guidance. And I don't do a whole lot of organic acid testing anymore. I don't do any or neurotransmitter, but I know a lot of clinicians do, and they get very good results with them. So it's nice to know that the science now is supporting what people have been doing for a long time. And we'll kind of go through how a naturopathic approach and really my approach to these cases of trial and error and seeing a lot of people and talking to my mentors over the years. And this is kind of what I boiled it down to. And this is the meat and potatoes of what people really want to know, I think. So for me, it's rule out all other etiologies of fatigue, hypothyroidism, sleep dysfunction, stress. But I, as you were saying earlier, I've never seen someone, it was just one thing. It's never been, yep, you feel like this because it's your thyroid. You feel like this because it's low testosterone. You feel like this because it's iron deficiency anemia. It's nice when those do come up because I'm like, cool, I know this is going to get them incrementally better each time, each intervention I do, but I still hopefully have, you know, not a long road to go. Look at the comorbidities. So if someone has, you know, the more food they have on their plate, the more work there's to be done. If someone comes in and that's their only problem is they're just tired all the time, like, well, that's cool. That's the only thing I have to deal with. But if they have if they have chronic pain, if they're not sleeping well, they're in a toxic relationship, they've got, you know, and that's usually who gets sent to me are these people that, to be, you know, flip, is that they're just a train wreck, right? They've been sick for 30 years, 20 years, And now they're like, look, you're my last hope. You know, my PCP heard about you and they don't even know what you do, but you know, they say you get some people better. Here I am. I don't even know what a naturopath is. So that's kind of who ends up seeing me a lot of the times. Psychiatric illness. I only had one patient that I can recall that he kind of met the CFS criteria, I would imagine. And he had some depression, but I think he had depression because he was so tired for so long. And he was taking 40 milligrams of Adderall a day, which is an astronomical amount of Adderall.
That's a bomb. Wow.
Yeah, that's a bomb. And it was just enough so he could go work at the tattoo parlor that he was a tattoo artist. And then I started kind of going down the road. I'm like, well, maybe he's just with all these chemicals. But his was infectious because he got mono. I tested him and his EBV titers were off the charts, and then he did actually quite well. But we did have to get him to see a counselor because he'd been sick for so long. All the stuff I was doing, he was really starting to become suicidal because he's just like, I'm never going to get better, never going to get better. I'm like, well, you know, I need you to see a therapist. I'm not a therapist. I got some great ones. So between psychotherapy and all the magic they were doing and then actual interventions to knock down his titers, his EBV titers, and then address his thyroid and adrenals. He recovered just fine and went off Adderall, and he went back to a normal life. And he was not about ready to change the tattoo situation. He owned it, and he was quite gifted. I mean, his artwork, his tats were quite nice. The other thing would be, so when I see people, I am known as being a vampire. So the phlebotomist in my community is that I run a lot of blood tests in these patients. And I do that for two reasons. Number one is that they've never been adequately worked up, right? They've only had bits and pieces looked at, right? Oh, I looked at just the thyroid and they were fine. And so I fill in the gaps. The other thing is that I use it as patient motivation. People, as I was saying earlier, are very empirical. So if they see abnormal values on their blood tests, they're much more likely to do what I'm asking them to do because they, you know, they get competitive. They want those inflammatory markers to come down. They want that vitamin D to get to the level that I'm suggesting, et cetera, et cetera.
And I think it's also, going back to what we were saying a little bit earlier, it's also deeply reassuring when people actually see tests come back and go, holy shit, here's the explanation of these symptoms that I'm experiencing.
Right, right. And we'll talk about some of the ones that are, and these are routine labs, right? A complete blood count, a chemistry panel, you know, thyroid panel, including free T4 and free T3, inflammatory markers. I do run creatine kinase just to see if they're having some kind of abnormal muscle wasting disease. And if those were abnormal, then I could send them for a biopsy, because what if they have myasthenia gravis or they have an autoimmune disease that is not it's a seronegative spondyloarthropathy, right? It's not ANA positive. So I do run all these, and I have yet to see creatine kinase be elevated enough to warrant a biopsy. Usually it's just because they may have exercised too much the day before and they had some muscle breakdown, then I retest it, it's normal. But these are diagnosis of exclusion, running hemoglobin A1C, you know, fasting insulin, these kind of things, C-peptide. Then the advanced approach, right? And that's when I do run things like methylmalonic acid plus serum B12. And the reason I run both of them is that methylmalonic acid is a much more sensitive marker for B12 deficiency than serum B12. And then all these are done fasting because B12 is stored in the liver and then released. But if you have someone who's on the lower normal range, but still within range of B12, then I know that that could be causing some of their symptoms and I might give them some injections or lozenges or whatever. RBC magnesium with serum magnesium. Magnesium is very difficult to assess. It's an intracellular cation. So if you combine serum and RBC, you can get a good idea of magnesium status. And again, it more is motivating factors, and particularly if they have pain. Ionized calcium and iron panel with transferrin and ferritin. And then hormones, right? DHEA sulfate, pregnenolone, testosterone, and fractionated estrogens. I'm looking for anything that might be causing some of their symptoms or worsening it. And in the beginning stages, these will probably be normal. In advanced stages, they're abnormal, but that's just because of the fact that they've been going through things so long, the hypothalamic, thyroid, pituitary, adrenal, ovarian axis is completely deranged. So everything's going to start getting off, which we know.
And I guess that's also where I always think there's a combination between having the kind of objective kind of scientific data and the kind of more subjective clinical interpretation of that data, right? And that's the figuring out of, is this just a symptom of the wider picture of what's going on, or is this potentially one of the drivers of what's going on?
Right. And I'll give you a good example, and so people can relate to, is that, so if someone is stressed out all the time and they have chronically elevated values of cortisol, cortisol inhibits the deiodinase enzyme that converts T4 to T3. So the brain registers that as, we don't have enough thyroid hormone, I need to make more thyroid hormone. So TSH goes up. So then what happens is it's spuriously elevated. So then that person gets put on thyroid medication, but it makes them feel worse, makes them feel hyperthyroid, right? They get anxious, diarrhea, tachycardic, they can't sleep. It's because the wrong gland is being addressed. You treat the adrenal gland and normalize cortisol rhythm, the thyroid fixes itself. And you'll see this quite a bit with, testosterone production, right? You don't have to go right to the big guns. And that's where naturopathy and in functional medicine, it's this whole therapeutic order. Let's start here, and then let's see how you, and once you see enough patients over time, no matter what the condition is, if you've seen that condition enough, it becomes predictable as far as you should be able to intervene at a certain level, and then there should be a certain outcome. If that outcome is not reached, one of a few things happen. Either the person was not compliant, right? They didn't take what you'd said to take. It wasn't a therapeutic dose, or your differential diagnosis is incorrect and you're barking up the wrong tree. So I usually don't go right to testosterone and some of the other ones until later when I've done a few things. And then maybe 3 months later, I'm like, okay, let's actually see what your hormone levels are now. And 99% of the time, unless they're just in the toilet, their hormones are in the toilet, their hormones will normalize or at least come up quite a bit. And then I'm like, cool, now we just need to do this. And usually I have to do some hormone replacement therapy, but it's usually just pregnenolone and DHEA. Not very often do I have to go to estrogen and testosterone because they don't need it. It totally normalizes because the body, right, will shunt everything all over the place to make itself seem as normal as possible. And we'll talk about some of that here in a minute. And then here comes the super advanced one that kind of became my claim to fame for some odd reason in some of the closed Facebook forums, the health forums for physicians, that they wanted to know what I was doing. And that's also why I wrote this presentation, is that I gave it a few years ago at a conference, because people were like, Dr. Borden sees a lot of chronic fatigue syndrome and he seems to be able to get people better. What's up with this? Most of my patients, like 90%, they actually had reactivated Epstein-Barr virus and or cytomegalovirus and or herpes virus 6. And when someone is testing for reactivated Epstein-Barr virus, it has to be a quantitative test, not a qualitative test. So you see this quite a bit, is that they get just a qualitative test, which just says EBV is positive or negative. Well, 90% of all individuals in the industrialized world have been exposed to Epstein-Barr at one time in their life. It's ubiquitous. You go to college, everybody's got it. Not everybody with infectious mono. But it has, and since Epstein-Barr is in the herpes virus family, then as humans, we never fully clear any herpes virus. That's why when you get chickenpox as a kid, you can end up with shingles later, is that the body's immune system keeps all of the viruses at bay and keeps them under control, but there needs to be an opportunity for them to react. They get an infection. They get really, really stressed out. They lose their job. They have an toxic relationship. Then all of a sudden, they get Lyme disease. They get mycoplasma, they get pneumonia, and then all of a sudden they're wiped. So when you test the titers, they'll see them through the roof. And what leads me to test people's titers is when they come in, they have chronic fatigue syndrome, I always ask them the same things. Do you have fever that comes and goes? Do you have lymph nodes swelling, cervical, your neck lymph nodes, do they swell and come and go? Do you have a sore throat that comes and goes? Almost always they will say yes. And almost always I test these titers and they usually are so high, the lab will just have the greater than symbol. They can't even test the titers anymore. And these are the titers. In order to actually diagnose someone with reactivation, this is what needs to be tested. And I see this happen a lot, is that people will come into me and say, oh yeah, my doctor tested me for Epstein-Barr, but they didn't test nuclear antigen, or they didn't test the early antigen. You know, you have to test the viral capsule antigen. You have to test all of these, and you have to have basically the early antigen, nuclear antigen, and the viral capsule antigen, IgG titers elevated. Not everybody. I mean, you also look at your patient. If some of these are elevated and if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, I'm going to treat presumptively. Right? Not everybody falls into these lovely patterns, but their symptom picture doesn't lie. And randomly, sometimes I'm like, well, they don't, their panel is negative and their symptoms are negative. Let me just treat them presumptively with the herbs because I've tried a few other things and nothing worked. And I would say half the time it works and half the time it doesn't when I treat them with the botanicals, which we'll get to in a minute.
But 50% ain't bad when you have people that have been ill for a long time.
Exactly. So I'm like, well, and the herbs are quite innocuous, right? They're very safe. And I just say, let's give it a therapeutic trial. If you don't feel better in 3 weeks, then it's not an infectious cause. But most often than not, people when they present with chronic fatigue syndrome and they have that picture of the lymph node swelling coming and going, the pharyngitis that comes and goes. And the reason that is that we, from my understanding, of the immunology papers is that what's happening is the virus is replicating. And as the virus replicates, you know, the virus is doing this and your immune system is trying to meet the virus and quell it. So that's why you get waxing and waning. So people feel terrible because these EBV or CMV or whatever, their virus is replicating. And then your immune system knocks it down. And then they have this quiescent period where they feel normal. Well, and they go through this cycle, right? About every 6 weeks, it waxes and wanes. Well, if it goes on long enough and they don't get the help they need or don't recover on their own, what happens is the circulating pool of white blood cells becomes depleted, and now these people are sick all the time. There is no more waxing and waning. They're always, and they will have lymphadenopathy on exam. I'll look in their throat and it's all swollen and red and, you know, usually these kind of things. So when I give them the botanicals, all this usually goes away, which kind of brings us just to treatment, is that conventionally, right, they're just saying do graded exercise and CBT, antidepressants, which I don't necessarily agree with unless, like you said earlier, they need to be implemented because that's just the time you need to buy. Like if they're suicidal, that's a time that they probably need a psychiatrist on board to have a talk with them and figure out.
Yeah, it can be helpful sometimes to stabilize someone enough to do the other work that needs to be done, but it's not a resolution to the actual issues. It's a kind of stabilizing process, and that's all that is my observation.
Exactly. And then you just get them off of them once they stabilize, because it's just masking it. And then a lot of antidepressants just cause more fatigue.
Right.
So sleep hygiene, if they're not sleeping well or sleeping too much, support groups, you know, and it depends on the person. If they're a person who needs people and they want people around, then I would say, hey, join a support group. If they're a person who's more reticent, then, and they're like, you know, I don't really want to talk about my feelings with anybody. Okay. You know, which also leads me to the world of homeopathy, because then that's a different kind of remedy. Iron therapy for non-anemic patients. And again, these are the conventional treatments based upon their diagnostic criteria. But when we get to the world of naturopathic or integrative medicine, functional medicine, here's a study where 2/3 of patients who had CFS said they were dissatisfied with the quality of medical care they were receiving, and they felt that their clinician had poor communication with them and educating regarding their diagnosis. So as especially you as a psychotherapist knows, you know, Alex, and a lot of people out there, is part of the therapeutic relationship and just part of the treatment begins when you just sit and listen to someone. Just for them to know that someone cares and someone hears them out and doesn't think they're crazy, you're already on the road to recovery, because they're like, thank God, someone listens to me, someone knows what's going on, and this is awesome, right? And And then also trying to find the accurate underlying abnormalities and address them. Counseling, graded exercise, sleep hygiene, diet is huge. Constitutional homeopathy, which is beyond the scope of this discussion, mitochondrial support, gemotherapy, legal therapy. And these are not things I'm doing all at once. These are, you know, I'm doing a couple things at a time, and we'll talk about why. As I said earlier, just thorough history and physical exam. I look for themes and trends, and I try to, so am I going to go down the infectious cause? Am I going to go down the mitochondrial dysfunction cause? Am I going to go down to, you know, immune dysregulation? Is it all of them? Is it mold? You know, that's going to basically dictate my treatment. A lot of times clinicians, particularly with CFS, because it can be complicated, they're just like, I'm just going to throw all this stuff at you and hopefully something sticks, which is not a good way to go, because number one, what if something goes wrong? It's too difficult to tell what happened because you gave them too many things to do. And two, these people are exhausted. You know, they can barely get out of bed in the morning, and now you give them a treatment plan that has 15 things on there, and they're like, whoa, you'll probably never see that person again, and then you won't be able to help them. So just keep it simple.
Yeah, and also it's a patient group that often have sensitivities to supplements or strong treatment programs. If you do too much too quickly, you just make things worse, right? So you have to take it slowly and some and kind of one or a few things at a time to see what's having what impact.
Yeah, good point. Thanks for bringing that up. And that's very true, is that, because imagine, remember, there's immune dysregulation, there's immune derangement. They have all these layers on. So they're not your normal person where you can give them something and you're like, cool, I'm going to give them some B6 and see what happens. It's like you could blast them out of the water. So I'm a big fan of test doses. I might just give them one thing in a very small amount and say, just take this, see how you feel. And then if you don't have an adverse reaction, that's a good thing, because now I can at least go up on it. If you have a bad reaction to it, well then, you know, I can't go any lower on this. Let's try something else. But I would say that my own clinical approach would be, so they see me, history, physical exam. I review a lot of their blood tests. For me, I only really care what's happened in the last 6 months as far as microbiome testing, blood tests, any diagnostic imaging over the last 12 months, because anything older than that, it's fine for a baseline, but they're in usually such a different state of life and affair in the course of their disease that I only care about things that are 6 months or older. Then I'm going to run my own battery of things. Typically, I usually give them a constitutional homeopathic remedy at the end of the first visit, and I run all the blood tests and I drain them, and then I have to come back in 3 weeks, and then I say, okay, what did the homeopathic do and not do, and what do your blood tests show? And maybe some microbiome testing, if they come in with lots of GI issues, I'm usually going to add that on, stool testing. I like them. I like doctors' data for their stool microbiology profiles. They're inexpensive, and they're very accurate, and they've been running them forever. And I know the owner of the company, I know the lead scientist, they're just great. So, and I have no affiliation with them, except that I like them a lot. Then if they're positive for Epstein-Barr, CMV, and or HHV, which almost always they are, then I give them these three botanicals that are gemotherapies. Gemotherapies are a type of herb. They're literally herbs on steroids. They're herbs that, so tinctures are alcohol and herb and a little bit of water, you know, macerated and then extracted. Glycerin is glycerin, a little bit of water, herb, and extracted. Gemotherapies are herbs, water, glycerin, and then they're also diluted to 1 to 10, so you have a little bit of that energetic aspect of it, so you're almost like there's still a physical substance in there because it's only a 10 dilution, but it's almost working on like cellular transcription. And these are the young shoots, the young buds, so energetically it's where all the plant is putting all of its goodies, but also biochemically, right? The plant is growing. It's the bud or it's the shoot or it's whatever that particular gemo is made from. It's super phytonutrient rich and dense. These three herbs work really well, and they work really fast, and they're well tolerated. Acer, Campestre, Juniperus, and Tamarix. The issue recently came up about 6 months ago is that Tamarix, by the few gemo companies in the world, do not seem to be making it anymore. And I'm not exactly sure why, maybe poor sales or they just can't source it. So now I've been using Acer and Juniperus with the medication Valtrex, which is valacyclovir. And it's working almost as well as the herbs, but better than just giving Valtrex by itself. And I know that not everybody listening has medication scope in their practice. So work with someone hopefully that does, if these are positive. And I add in what's called an oligo element. An oligo element is just a physiological dose of minerals, not a pharmacological, and they're already ionized. So they're already charged, basically. Similar to what you would do if you took it and had hydrochloric acid molecules added. Copper, gold, silver, people might get a little concerned when they see, you know, gold and silver. These are in parts per million. And gold is used in Ayurvedic medicine and has for 5,000 years. Silver, you want to make sure it's in parts per million, right? Unless you want to end up with a condition that's rare called a gyria or a jaria, where people turn into Smurfs. And I have seen it once in my residency. There was a woman who bought a substandard colloidal silver off Amazon. And it was just total garbage. And she drank too much and she turned blue. And she was blue for the rest of her life. And it was odd. I felt really bad for her. And it was weird because, like, sometimes when I would see her, she would be like blue and then sometimes like purplish and then sometimes like this green hue, and it was all over her body. It was head to toe.
It was
certainly enlightening.
Stuff you read in the textbooks, you rarely see it.
I mean, it's like, it's really only, it's unheard of unless someone takes too much silver. It was during my residency, and it was one in a billion probably, but I'm glad I saw it. Never seen it. And then giving them a potent multivitamin mineral, but again, test dosing and making sure it's hypoallergenic. And the reason I'm giving them this, right, is I got to get some nutrients into the system. So mitochondrial precursors, I've got to get the B complex to help modulate cortisol production and neurotransmitter production and help with their immune system. And instead of giving a lot of supplements, you can achieve it with a nice multivitamin mineral. The prebiotics, probiotics, Saccharomyces boulardii. I'm a big fan of these for a lot of reasons, but I put two papers in here that showed in chronic fatigue syndrome, literally inflammation in the gastrointestinal tract worsening CFS symptoms. So you want to put out the fire. And probiotics, you just be cautious of the probiotics you get, because most of the stuff on the market, there's been independent studies that they're either contaminated with pathogenic bacteria or they don't even meet label claim. So just get a good quality probiotic, and probiotics are wonderful as long as you take them and they do lots of things. And I'm not get into strain and genus, species, strain specificity, just a nice, well-rounded one, because there's no studies showing it one way or the other, like this particular one does it. But it has a washout effect, right? Probiotics really only work as long as you take them, and depending on the strain, up to a certain amount of time after you stop. Prebiotics are indigestible fibers that feed your healthy flora to grow. XOS, which is oligosaccharide, is nice versus FOS. You usually need 10 to 20 grams to make a difference. Most people don't tolerate that. GOS, galacto-oligosaccharide, you need about 5. XOS, you only need about 2. And it's made from non-GMO corb cob, and you only need about 2 grams a day. It's a powder. I like it as a powder so I can titrate with people. I'm like, sprinkle some on your food, keep increasing it. And then Saccharomyces boulardii, very important. It's a non-colonizing beneficial yeast that's wonderful, that it feeds your healthy flora to grow. It increases secretory IgA. It's immunomodulatory, very anti-inflammatory. Here's a whole paper on it. If you ever have insomnia, read that. That'll put you right out. but it's wonderful. And it's, you can really give people a lot of it. The only concern would be people that have like cachexia from AIDS or cancer. There are some case reports of fungemia, but again, that's not this patient population. CFS, that's not a problem. Is that you want to start stimulating the immune system, modulating it, calming the fire, getting their immune system to kind of recoup on its own so they can start healing themselves. So now they saw me the first time, they come back in 3 weeks. Are you better, worse? Here's what your lab showed. If it's EBV positive, I'm gonna give you these herbs. Come back in 6 weeks. I would say 98% of the time, these people are 90% better. Going from an energy level of an average of 3, 10 being the most, you know, 3 being nothing. And now they're like, oh my God, this is fantastic. So for those people, I just give them this herb called Ribes nigrum, which is black currant, is a gemo. It's very stimulating, very yang tonifying. So I might give someone like 5 drops and say, okay, and then increase. So for those though that aren't better, right, but they responded to treatment, they're like, I feel better, but I'm like 40% there. I just repeat the herbs and then, you know, I might add in Valtrex or something. For those 2% of the 150 to 200 cases of CFS I've seen that have not responded to the herbs, and then I will give them more antivirals. You know, Valtrex is very safe. I do like to take breaks. I keep them on a paddle protective, any of your milk thistle, juniperus, which is juniper, any of these things to protect the liver is great. And then this humic acid from Allergy Research Group is awesome because humic acid has been around since the earth was formed. It's in the soil, it's in peat bogs, it's where any of the volcanoes. I mean, Iceland is just like humic acid dream. And we understand very well the mechanism of action, that it actually interferes with the virus's ability to attach to a host cell, penetrate, and reproduce. So it's inhibiting its ability to replicate. So if someone has the herpes HHV6 or HSV1 or 2 or any of these herpes viruses, I have seen humic acid work really well. And you can do maintenance doses. I have some patients, they just take one a day. After a loading dose, they get better. And then they might take breaks because I don't like the body to get used to it. And then if their symptoms come back, they just go back on one a day and they feel totally fine. And here's a whole slew of papers showing it. So what about those people? So for all our listeners out there, they're like, yeah, I know all that. I do all these things. I'm a you know, or I implemented what Dr. Bourne had to say, but there was no infectious cause. They don't have those symptoms that wax and wane. You know, what do I do? Then it's time to dig some more, right? But don't mess around with them, because, you know, a lot of these people, and you probably just experienced a lot in your clinic, is that these people have seen usually so many doctors, so many clinics, they're usually broke. And the last thing you want to do is add more financial stress to their lives. So unless you know what you're doing, or, you know, send them to someone who does, or just be very systematic. And that's when I start digging into heavy metals. And there's a good amount of evidence that, you know, heavy metals, you know, they adversely affect the thyroid gland, the adrenal gland, they inhibit mitochondrial function. So I will assess people for heavy metals with unprovoked urine and blood. So no chelating agents, you know, and then I compare their data to the CDC data. Mold. I'm not a mold expert, but the patient I was referring to before that fortunately stuck with me for a couple of years. And I mean, I did everything with her and she just kept sticking through it. And, you know, I was like, what is going on? She went for maybe after a year and a half, I got her 25% better, you know, maybe. And she was one of these plugging along. I mean, like the homeopathy helped with her mood, but that's it. I was giving her B12 and we were doing everything. And so finally, I was like, you know, what about mold? You know, and I used to practice in an area in the United States, in the San Francisco Bay, in Alameda, California, it's on the water. Everything is old and everything is full of mold. And she said, yeah, definitely my house is mold. And I was like, does it smell musky? She's like, not really. And I said, you know, and I gave her a mold questionnaire and I said, where do you work? So it happens that she was working in Oakland in an old abandoned warehouse that a company purchased but never remediated, never removed all the mold and the asbestos. They didn't do anything. And she was working there. And I said, you know, are there any other people at your work that have same symptoms as you? She's like, oh, yeah, a bunch of my coworkers. They're wow. all exhausted wow. all the time. And I was like, well, I don't like to get involved when it comes to legal stuff unless I have to. But I said, look, I think you should call the CDC and or the Department of Health. Sorry, I said call the Oakland Department of Health and just talk to them and see if someone will come and inspect the building, because you know this company wanted to cut corners and they. So yeah, turns out they came in, they tested it. Place was totally mold infested, and they I don't know if. I don't think there was a lawsuit. I think what ended up happening was is that the company shut them down. They had to move all the employees. We treated her mold. She's totally fine.
Wow. And fascinating.
It was fascinating. I'm like, man, lesson learned for me. It took me almost 2 years to just have a light bulb moment, probably a year and a half. And I was like, this poor woman just fortunately stuck with it. And here's a good paper about mycotoxins in patients with chronic fatigue syndrome. And again, it has to do with genetic susceptibility. They just can't seem, because again, if mold caused CFS for everybody in this woman's workplace would have been had the same symptoms, but only maybe five of the employees did. It has to do with genetics. They just couldn't clear the mold, deal with the mold. It probably also didn't help that she lived in a moldy area, but most places in the Bay are pretty moldy because it's near the water and stuff's old, right? It was all built in the 70s and not real well, they're real well insulated for mold deterrence. Look for other infections, Lyme disease, you know, tick-borne illnesses, addressed dysglycemia, food allergies, sensitivities, and tolerances. Again, none of these are going to be your magic bullet. The mold one was an outlier, but if looking at all of these things, right, and there is a difference between a food allergy, a sensitivity, and intolerance. An allergy, a food allergy is a type 1 IgE-mediated immune reaction. That's the person who eats a food, you know, say, you know, shrimp, and their face blows up, or they get hives or a scratchy throat, all the way to anaphylaxis, and they need an EpiPen, or they're going to die.
Right.
An intolerance is actually an enzyme insufficiency or deficiency where the symptoms are relegated to the gastrointestinal tract only. Lactose intolerance being the most common in the industrialized world. You don't have enough of the enzyme lactase to break down lactose. Food sensitivity is a world that you and I mostly deal with, and that's totally different. So it may or may not be mediated by the immune system. So that is why when patients, you know, come off the share screen here so you can see me, is that, you know, with food sensitivities is that you may or may not have systemic effects. You may eat the food and get brain fog, or you may get headaches or joint pain. That's mediated, we believe, by the immune system. So when you're running an IgG food panel, that sensitivity, unless it's actually mediated by the immune system, will be spuriously negative. That's why the allergy elimination diet is the gold standard for food sensitivities and intolerances, because you would be able to pick up things that are not mediated by the immune system. But these are, remember, it's like you have all these things that are just, if you have a cup that's half full of water and you add on mold and chemicals and toxicants and infections and, you know, food issues that are causing inflammation in that individual, eventually that cup overflows. And your job as a clinician is to keep taking each one of those things away to get incrementally better, particularly with the complex cases who are not responding to normal treatments when you're like, well, I'm doing these things and they're not responding. So,
and particularly with the food intolerances, yeah. It's also, again, it's often a symptom rather than the cause, right? It's understanding what's happening, be it gut permeability or whatever it may be, which is actually the reason why the immune system is starting to respond in the way that it is.
That's exactly. So imagine, right, you have this immune dysregulation and it's already kind of in overdrive and not responding to things, and the endocrine system's not responding, right, because they all are in crosstalk. Then you have this intestinal hyperpermeability, leaky gut. So here's your normal gap junction. Here's your normal intestinal junctions. Now you have leaky gut, so you have gap junctions. So all these things you're putting in your system, our proteins are leaking through, and the immune system's like, whoa, that's an invader. And it's further agitating an already over-agitated immune system. So if you start cleaning up the gastrointestinal tract, all of a sudden these food sensitivities, they may go away completely, or at least they're just mitigated, right? Where they're like, you know, I had that, I went to a dinner party, I had a cupcake, and I was fine. I ate that second cupcake, and I paid the price. Yeah. And that's typically what happens. If you have a straight-up food intolerance where you have like a genetic deletion and you're not producing any of that enzyme, that's not going to be rectified. You just have to avoid it. Celiac disease. You're just not going to be able to break down gluten. So you need to avoid it for life. There's just no way around it. Then, so then now you got, for me anyway, it's like 0.5% left, right? Nobody wound up with any of my anything, right? They didn't have mold, they didn't have heavy metals, they didn't have anything. So, or which is actually more common, is that everything I did helped, but they still got a little bit of the symptoms left and their life is not optimal. We want to get people optimal, right? Have their 100% quality of life back. That's what we strive for. Then I am into mitochondrial support. But as we discussed earlier in those papers, unless you fix the underlying problems, you fix the mitochondria, you can throw mitochondrial precursors at these people all day and you won't get any or minimal ATP production. So that's where something like lipid replacement therapy comes in, which is NT factor, which actually what the studies are showing, it's all theoretical, but they have good mechanism papers that it actually repairs the mitochondrial membrane. So if you have a leaky mitochondria, then you know, you're putting all these nutrients in, it can't produce the ATP. But if you repair the mitochondrial membrane, then you can start giving these precursors like coenzyme Q10 and NADH and magnesium. And all of a sudden people start responding. And this was my lesson learned, is I would see people when I first started my career out with these symptoms and I'm giving them all these things, they're not really responding. Then all of a sudden I start doing this at the end after I've treated them for a while. And I, lo and behold, it was like miracles, right? They're just hyper responders to a little bit of CoQ10 and a little bit of NT factor. I like that the NT factor comes in these nice chocolate chewables that have CoQ10 in them. And you can just snack on those things all day. And it's real chocolate. And people love them. And you can give them to kids. You can give them to everybody. You know, they're very safe. You can't really OD. And one of the points is, right, is to repair the mitochondrial membrane and repair all cellular membranes, so they actually start retaining their fluid membrane, transmembrane ability, so you actually get good talk between cells. Other precursors, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's the appealing alternative to the cupcakes at the dinner party, right?
Yes, it is. Just hand them out. You know, like, here's some real chocolate. You get to have healthy lipids. And what's nice about, so what is NT factor is that it's lecithin, but if you buy egg lecithin or you buy soy lecithin, they will vary from batch to batch. And you know, phospholipids, they oxidize quickly anyway, but NT factors patents are around the blend. So you get the full blend of phospholipids and glycophospholipids. But what you're also getting is they add some things to some of the products that help stabilize it from oxidation. It'll still oxidize. The lipids are lipids, but it slows down the rate of oxidation. So what's nice is that of oxidation, what's nice about NT factor, you're getting the same standardized amount of all the phospholipids and glycophospholipids every single time. And most of the studies, the original studies, were done in fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome. And they have this great study on cancer patients and cancer-induced fatigue. Not only did the fatigue improve, but even better for oncologists, they showed that it did not interact with any of the chemo drugs. So it was nice to be able to sit here and pump these people full of lipids, and then the oncologist, rightfully so, says, well, I don't know what that is. I don't want it to mess with my treatment. Here's a paper showing with a number of different chemo agents, it did not interact adversely. So and it is tasty, and it's a better alternative to your cupcakes. And I just put in slides about other mitochondrial support that I like to use, as well as what has good data to support it. Carnitine, right? The reason I put these in different forms is that the different form of carnitine has different effects in the body. L-carnitine is not the same thing as acetyl L-carnitine. But in these two studies, that when they gave people a mix of carnitine, the second one, the carnitine derivatives, they actually had better improvements than giving just one type of carnitine, which makes sense, right? If they have different biochemical interactions with the body, it would make sense that giving different ones, and preferably away from other amino acids, because there's some theoretical competitive inhibition. I like to just give it away from food or with carbohydrates, since there's no amino acids there. Alpha-lipoic acid, you know, a thiol containing molecule. The caution with this is if they have dysglycemia and orthostatic hypotension and and they have reactive hypoglycemia after they eat meals, which is like in postprandial syndrome, right? So their blood sugar drops when they eat foods. Then this is going to drop their blood sugar even more because it's a hypoglycemic agent. That's why it's great in diabetics. But any of the thiol-containing molecules, you know, really high-dose glutathione. There's a debate whether glutathione is stable orally. That debate, fortunately, has been solved that if you have it in an acetylated form, it's much more likely to be stable. And it actually can bypass a little bit of the first pass effect of the liver and get right into the cells where we naturally deacetylase it and you have free floating glutathione in to be used intracellular where your mitochondria is. Plus, it's great for people with chemical sensitivities and works a little better than alpha-lipoic acid, especially for those that can't do injections or IV therapies in their scope. Last, getting towards the end here would be, you know, just giving people good essential fatty acids, high quality, fast, similar to the lipid replacement therapy. So some people get nervous when they see omega-6 in my slides because they just immediately go to arachidonic acid. But if you remember, gamma-linolenic acids like GLA from borage oil and evening primrose and currant, they're very anti-inflammatory. Mm. And omega-9 oleic acid that's found in avocado oil and olive oil is great. So I like to kind of change oils up in people to start repairing membranes and getting their mitochondria working. Plus, it's good for mood. It's anti-inflammatory. We know inflammation plays a significant role in CFS. So all the more reason to take a nice high-quality one that it is not subjected to peroxidation. If people don't really want to use the GMOs or they can't get a hold of them, and I'm a big fan of just adaptogens, right? Withania, which is ashwagandha, Panax ginseng, and this is where I also like to have a little soapbox moment about the ginsengs are a good way to look at it is that, you know, they're these adaptogens, they are on spectrums. So if you have that patient who comes in and they're wired and tired, you don't really want to give them a stimulating adaptogen like rhodiola or Panax ginseng, or if you do, just go really low dose. You might want to give them a more yin tonifying herb like American ginseng or ashwagandha or holy basil, because that's going to be much more tonifying. The person who comes in and they're totally wiped out and they're cold and they're, you know, tired, yeah, give them those stimulating herbs because they need them. And I see this quite a bit. People come in, they're like, oh, yeah, I took that. It just made me feel all jittery. It's because it was just the wrong.
Sometimes people have to have enough. Its system's really crashed and it's really kind of overstimulated trying to compensate for the crash. It makes sense to give them stuff to energize, but as you say, actually the energy just goes into the nervous system and actually then it causes more of a crash. So yeah, you have to really respond to, you have to use the body as a feedback loop, I think, sometimes to hit the,
that's
right,
right.
Hit the right note.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I think people miss a lot. They're like, oh, well, they have CFS. You know, I've had plenty of people with CFS in the beginning to middle of their syndrome, where they're still, I mean, because they're high energy people anyway. So right, exactly. Their baseline was like me. I mean, their baseline's already up here. And so CFS knocked them down to a normal energy level. So I'm like, I'm not going to give you Panax ginseng. I'm going to give these. The people that come in, like that one woman who had the mold, I was giving her the stimulants of the stimulants in the nutrient and botanical world. I mean, more doses than I've ever given anybody. And I'm just, she'd come back and I'm like, so what are you doing? She's like, I don't know. I was like, man, this is so weird. Something else has got to be going on. Astragalus, I'm a big fan of astragalus because not only is it, most people know for the polysaccharides is immune stimulating, but in Chinese medicine, it's a huge adaptogen. So you get, and most adaptogens also are immune modulating as well, but astragalus is nice because you get the immune support and you get the adrenal support. You know, these are just other strategies I put in. You know, don't give up on your patients and, you know, whether you're going to use hormone replacements, intramuscular IV therapies, physiotherapy, hydro, acupuncture, massage, craniosacral. I don't know if there's any studies per se on low-dose naltrexone with CFS. There certainly is in fibromyalgia. Just don't use it if they're on opiates. Germanium is another one I like a lot because there is a study on chronic fatigue syndrome, and germanium has been used a lot because it's a really strong antioxidant. again, just use something like allergy research groups, because some of the germanium products out there are inorganic germanium, and that will cause acute renal failure. So you have to use the organic germanium.
Right.
And they come as powder, chewable, capsule, and there's some good data for it with mitochondrial function. Then cancer, it's mostly used in IVs because you have to get enough into someone, but it does work well. Colostrum, I like it as a phospholipid powder, because then you get, again, you're getting the lipids. It's a powder that you can titrate, because some people, it does have a fair, like 40% lactose. It might mess with their stomach a little bit, you know, and just kind of, if you need some immune support. So kind of the summation would be, you know, that you basically, it's a multi-system, multifactorial condition that if you listen to it with an open heart, scientific inquiry, your outcomes will be improved. Diagnose them first, at least try to. Consider the naturopathic therapeutic order and don't overwhelm. And KISS would be, you know, just keep it simple. Just a couple things at a time. It may be some hand-holding in the beginning, but you'll have better outcomes in the end. So that was a
powerhouse information. maybe just as a summary, there's a lot of pieces that we've covered, and I think in many ways we've kind of done two interviews in one, in a sense of kind of laying out the kind of context and the background, and then coming more into the kind of potential kind of treatment paths. If you were to summarize, you mentioned NT Facts, particularly if you were to summarize a few kind of key products. I know that you're kind of here speaking independently, but you also work with Allergy Research Group, being a great sponsor for us. Maybe just a few recommendations that you want to just kind of bring out at the end here.
Yeah, sure. So once you have the underlying cause, but even if while you're digging, right, you may have to just do something to get them better while you have to dig. There's many times that, you know, they've seen everybody, that you're the last hope. You just got to keep working with them, keep going. So you can at least make some inroads, and that would be things like NT factor, germanium, adaptogenic herbs. You know, if thyroid's not coming up, you can even use the glandulars. I'm not a big glandular prescriber, but I know a lot of practitioners, particularly in the UK, a lot of nutritional therapists love the glandulars, because, you know, again, you know, Allergy Research Group's glandulars are fantastic, because unlike a lot of other companies, the glandulars that Allergy Research Group uses from New Zealand and Argentina, they are not defatted and they're not chemically washed. They're literally grown under strict husbandry conditions in New Zealand, for example, or Australia. The animals are, you know, they have the business happens with the animals, and then they're literally, they are desiccated, the lyophilized, they're just washed off, and then they're immediately encapsulated. Or we encapsulate them. So you're actually getting all of the nutrients, all of the peptides, all of the hormones in those. So I know a lot of practitioners that they get great results of using the thyroid or the adrenal or the spleen or the, you know, what have you, and using the adaptogens, because it's going to help modulate that stress response, it'll help with their fatigue, help their immune system. The adaptogens, and I would say germanium and NT factor would probably be my, and a multivitamin would be where I would go to first while I'm digging and talking to them and doing labs and waiting for the labs to come in. And even when I do get the labs, I still keep them on. And for maintenance, they usually always end up on these botanicals.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic point, actually, is kind of just going back to what we were saying a bit earlier, that there are, although it's super patient specific in terms of figuring out what's going on, there are these kind of underlying core principles that for the vast majority of people will have significant benefits in terms of supporting the system along the way of that journey.
That's right. I mean, and Saccharomyces would be on there. And again, it's not all at once. Like the first appointment, I might say, you know, let's get you some Saccharomyces boulardii, let's get you on a good probiotic, let's start with the multi, come back, how you doing? Okay, let's get you on some sleep hygiene, phosphatidylserine, and a combination of phosphatidylserine, phosphatic acid helps really well because it competes for cortisol binding sites, so it lowers cortisol throughout the night. I usually have people 400 milligrams at the end of dinner, and by the time they're ready to go to sleep, they don't have those cortisol surges. And then over time, with the adaptogens, their cortisol regulates itself on its own.
Awesome. There's there's so many questions I could have asked you on the way that I was mindful of time. I was like, I need to just let Todd kind of get to the end of this presentation within the time. But thank you so much for sharing just so much amazing information. This has been immensely helpful for people. Just Great. To give a shout out to Allergy Research Group, who are one of the sponsors of the conference. And we've worked with their products and NutriLink, who are the distributor here in the UK. We've had probably 15-year relationship now working with them, have some excellent products. So a thank you to Allergy Research Group and NutriLink, but also Dr. Bourne, thank you so much for sharing so much wisdom. We really appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate it. Hope this helps everybody. And thanks for putting this conference together. And I think it's going to help a lot of people. And it's free, so people have no reason not to listen.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated.
All right. All right. Take care. Cheers.